Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today on the show, I'm joined with Melissa, who is a behavioral analyst who helps those find ABA agencies and therapists that are right for them. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and I'll see you on the other side. See you there. Welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today, I'm joined with Melissa, who is a behavioral analyst working with ABA. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and we'll get going.
Well, I became a board certified behavior analyst back when my son was 2 years old and diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. I was told by professionals that he would never speak and would rely on me for the rest of his life. And I decided that we weren't going to accept that. He was going to have a happy, healthy life, no matter what that looked like. But I was going to do whatever I could to help him. At the time, I was teaching. And so throughout his journey, I got into ABA, I became an RBT, and then I became a board certified behavior analyst. And now I own my own company called Bloom Health, where I help parents kind of do the same thing, like decide that they are going to do the best thing that they can for their child and receive adequate education and training and information. So.
All right. Now, why do you feel ABA has gotten such a bad rap? Is it because people are parroting what they hear and not doing their own research, or is it fair?
Honestly, it's a little fair. It is a little fair. ABA can be an incredible resource and a great tool just because of understanding how behavior works, especially for an individual who is nonverbal and can't understand contingencies and also can't explain contingencies well. However, there's a history of ABA being misused and kind of being in the attitude of normalizing people on the spectrum, also using procedures that aren't ethical. Doesn't in itself make ABA a bad thing. The principles of ABA are pretty solid, but depending on the practitioner, depending on, the practices put into place, one of my big messages and a guide that I give out is how to kind of spot if an ABA company is misusing their resources, and kind of how to navigate the conversation and make sure that your child is getting the treatment that they deserve.
And for those out there who are not sure, what can you explain what ABA is?
ABA is Applied Behavioral Analysis, and it was constructed over time as a way of teaching skills to a child who may not have verbal skills, or even an adult who may not have verbal skills. So it takes, very critical skills for a child or a person to be able to thrive independently, and breaks them down and teaches them in a way that's going to make sense to somebody who may not be able to understand instructions the way that a person with a lot of language would understand them. So I think another thing that gives it a bad rep is that it is very much about, repetition, reinforcement. And people look at that and they think, that looks very daunting. It looks like a lot of work, but if it's done right, it's done through lots of play opportunities, lots of encouragement, and natural environment. So a child would be learning in the environment that they would already be in instead of seated at a table and drilling out skills all day.
So they would be learning in their homes instead of inside a
Center. I personally, you know, there are ABA companies that do both. There's some that do center-based programming, and there's some that do, you know, home-based. I would recommend, you know, if a child is most likely needing most of their help at home, like with self-care, adaptive skills, lots of language, then the home is usually the best setting. A center is good if there's like socialization opportunities there, but again, only if done right. I'm very hesitant on center-based programs just because it tends to teach the child how to do things in that location, in that center, instead of everywhere where they would naturally use it.
I totally agree with you on that, because I feel it's more important to learn in your own environment than somewhere else.
Yes.
Because you have that comfort of your home, and you kick out that fear of, oh, I'm somewhere new and I got to learn all this, where I'm in my comforts, I can feel a little bit more at ease and relaxed.
Right. And honestly, at home, it's better, because I learned a lot by participating in my son's therapy and being there and seeing what was going on, so that I kind of knew what was being worked on, and I knew how to carry it out at home too. So my parenting changed a lot. You know, the way I reacted to certain attempts of communication, and how I, you know, slowly encouraged but didn't expect, you know, behaviors that may not have been appropriate for his age range. Like sometimes, you know, people expect their kids to behave perfectly, and it's just not realistic for any child, let alone one that, you know, maybe dealing with sensory issues or maybe having to take in the environment in a very different way. So I loved in-home, because not only was it more natural for the child, but then I could see what was happening and I could learn.
Now, what would you say to those who have had bad experiences with ABA? How would you get them to like reevaluate and find a better ABA therapist?
Honestly, you know, if someone has experienced a bad ABA encounter, that's going to be very hard for that person to get over. And I can 100% understand that. So I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, come back to ABA, give it another chance, because that might be a big ask for someone. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is educate yourself on what ABA is supposed to be, and that systematic approach to learning new skills, and learn how to implement some of the core foundational principles in the home. And if you get like really well versed in that, then if you do decide that you want to try ABA again in the future, then you know what the red flags are and you know what the green flags are, like when something is going very well. I think it's more being equipped to evaluate than it is like saying, no, definitely, you know, come back. It might not even be right for the family. Sometimes families are approved and it's just not the right approach for them.
All right. What is a typical day like for you?
Oh, for me. I have a 10-year-old on the spectrum, but then I also have a 3-month-old baby. So every day is a little different. But what I do is, you know, I create trainings for parents who maybe can't, like they might be on a wait list for services and they need to know how to implement some ABA practices at home, and not traditional ABA therapy, but natural environment, you know, how to parent with the, like the mechanics of behavior in mind. So, you know, how behavior works, how to teach new skills for someone who might not be verbal. I help parents with that. So I do direct one-to-one calls with that. I also create a lot of resources that are just free for parents so that they can, you know, get educated, get, you know, some of the help that they need if they can't do one-to-one. And then I also do group trainings as well. So a big one, like I mentioned, I do have a guide out at this point of the top 10, kind of my top 10 red flags of an ABA program. And if you are looking for something that has that same behavioral approach, you know, we offer those services without you having to be in an ABA program, because then it gets in with insurance, you know, you never know what you're going to be approved for. And then, I honestly, in my heart of hearts, do believe that many ABA programs don't go at it trying to be detrimental to someone, but they struggle with staff shortages and they struggle with, you know, all kinds of things that make decision making very hard to be for the benefit of children. So I like to help parents, like, you learn how to do these things at home with your child, so that my day could look like, you know, back to back direct with clients. It could look like I'm doing groups and lives and just offering those education materials to people.
And then, do you have an age range you work with?
I don't necessarily. I specialize in early childhood, you know, so from like about a year old to 8 years old, that's where, you know, the early intervention process happens. But ABA principles could be used for everybody. I mean, there are even some that I use for myself, like on myself, just to teach myself new habits and new behaviors. So no age range, but I will say that most of the people that I work with are younger.
Now, is it mostly parents, or do you have those who are older on the spectrum that come to you and say, listen, I need help, can you help me?
Yeah, I've yet to have someone who is an adult approach me as an individual. It's mostly parents, or I even do like some training resources for teachers that may have children on the spectrum in their classroom and just need to know how to be more conscientious of what that person might need. But I mean, I would love to work with individuals who are, you know, just like, I would like help with this particular, I have this goal for myself that I don't know how to reach. A lot of what ABA could be used for is just small attainable goals working up to a big one.
So. Now, how do you think we can change the minds of people about ABA? I mean, we know there's fear in their mind about it because of what they've read. How can we change that, get the fear out of them, and make them understand there are good ABA programs out there?
You know, again, I think educating them and helping them to be able to evaluate what's going to make a good program and what's not. You know, I was just talking to a client of mine earlier today, and she said, you know, this ABA company wants to have someone with me because my child struggles with running away, and they want to have the therapist with me when I go out, like to the store and to in different places, to help work through those things. And that's a sign of a really good program. Like someone that's like, here's what your needs are, let me help you achieve that. So I think it's understanding what ABA should be doing. And if you know that ABA is meant to be serving your family and supporting your family, not the other way around, where they're telling you, you need to be doing this, this, and this, and it's not appropriate for your family. I think fear comes from a lack of understanding and knowing. Mm-hmm. And if you know about something and what it's meant to look like, there's no reason to fear it. And you can choose a program that actually works for you.
Now, would you say that ABA has improved over time?
I would. Yeah, I would. I've been a part of a few different companies at this point, each one, you know, a little bit more progressive and a little bit more in understanding of individual client needs instead of, you know, trying to blanket treatment. And I do know that there is a lot of call for reform, you know, by other BCBAs as well. Just to really put our service in check and make sure that, you know, we're acting in the best interest of our families and our clients. So I do think it has changed quite a bit over time. And with the development of social media, people are really able to get their words out there, and it's making a lot of progress.
Now, what are some of the biggest worries that parents have come to you about with their kid?
A big one is communication skills. If a child's nonverbal, that is a big one. You know, how do I get how do I know what my child needs? If something happens to them, what, like, how do I know? So we, communication is almost always, you know, a big one. Another thing that is a huge part of ABA services and I get all the time is safety skills, like knowing not to run away if you're out somewhere, or if you do engage in self-stimulatory behavior, making sure that it's not something that could potentially be harmful. I've worked with a client who their self-stimulatory behavior was grinding their teeth, which could end up fracturing jaw and you know, if you just some making sure that, you know, you're getting that stimulation that you need, but mm-hmm. in a way that's not going to harm yourself over time. So I think those are probably my two most common protocols, is learning safe self-stimulatory behavior and increasing communication.
Yeah, the reason I laughed is I tend to grind my teeth a lot. I mean, it's almost involuntary at times. It's either when I'm stressed or when I'm anxious or nervous or upset. I yep. just wind up grinding my teeth. And it's come to the point where I went to a new dentist, and after they look at my x-rays, they go to me, you grind your teeth, don't you? I'm like, you're like, you need a bite plate. I'm thinking, a bite plate's not going to help if I grind my teeth all the time.
Exactly. That just helps at one point of the day. It doesn't help the rest.
Yeah. Has ABA helped your son at all?
A lot. We were very blessed in the fact that even though I didn't really know much about it, he had his first BCBA was incredible. And it was a very rare opportunity, because the BCBA would write the treatment plans and he'd be the one to come to the house and actually work with him. So there was no like lost in translation. Like, he came up with the ideas and he put them into place. A lot of times if you have to train technicians, it's a little bit more difficult. But this BCBA really knew my son and what he needed and how to interact with them and how to get him interested in playing, you know, cooperatively. And it really, really helped. I just saw my son, because my son had been in speech and OT and all these other therapies and they weren't going well at all, but they weren't going well because he hadn't learned the value of sitting with a person and learning from them. He just hadn't learned that skill yet. And a lot of times that's like barrier number one. And if you're not getting very far in therapies, that's probably like because you just haven't learned the value of sitting with them and learning from them. And once we were able to connect with my son in that way, he really took off. I mean, I was told he'd never talk, and now he's 10 years old and hosts his own YouTube channel. And wow. Yeah, better language skills than even I have. So, boy, it couldn't have been a more different outcome than what I was told.
Now, how is he handling school and everything, with everything going on?
He's doing very well. He very much enjoys school. He actually today just, he wanted to join the school's running club. So wow. He started that. He started in a kind of a combined special needs classroom. And now he's mainstream and he's functioning very well. And he has friends that come over to the house and want to play with him, and just very happy kid. He's a very happy little guy.
Now, what have you learned yourself about the autism community coming into it as an adult with a son who's on the spectrum?
Well, I've learned, one, that all of us have, like, being a part of the diagnostic process and seeing the characteristics. You know, there are many characteristics that even I have that are neurodivergent and possibly mm-hmm. spectrum characteristics. So we all can really learn. We can really learn how to be sensitive and caring toward one another, because it's really not just you either have this label or you don't. It's more like at what level do you have the characteristics? And if so, wherever you're at, how do you best learn? It's really made me kind of see every person, whether they're on the spectrum or not, as their own kind of human being. Like they are their own person and they're going to learn in their own way. And it's just really increased like my just kind of love for all that is unique. You know, you are going to learn in your very own specific way and have your specific characteristics. And that's so cool. Like you don't have to fit into any kind of in stigma or anything that is normal, because there really is no normal. Everybody has something. Everybody stims in some mm-hmm. way. Everyone does. And learning more about these things really just it opened up my horizons quite a bit and taught me a lot about myself and the characteristics that I have.
Now, have you gotten any grief from the community about you going being into ABA? Because I know they frown upon it.
At some points, yes. I have not very much. I've been pretty blessed. I know that as I continue on and, you know, I'm active on social media and I do have a following there, and especially with my company, like people might think, oh, you're trying to promote ABA, but I'm really not, you know, having been in the ABA community, I can honestly say that I don't feel that it's always the best option for everybody. Yeah, I have those letters that can attach to my name as a BCBA, but that just makes me more conscientious of, you know, who needs something like that and who doesn't. So I'm very careful. You know, I don't promote ABA to everybody, and I don't say, you know, ABA is the best thing on the planet, because for everyone, it's not. Like for some people, it's great. It worked well for my son, but it was because of the way it was done. So anytime someone does have a negative comment about ABA, I'm usually just very much like, I'm really sorry that happened and that you have this opinion on it. And I'd love to hear more of why that is, you know, what are there any questions that I can answer for you? So yeah, at times, but not much.
No, we'll circle back to your son for a minute. How did he handle during the lockdown? Because I know a lot of people on the spectrum have had troubles with the lockdown.
Yeah, he did. he did have a little bit of a tough time. What I did, I was very grateful to have had, you know, my education and training during that time, because I was able to put some stuff into place that helped. If I broke his day up and I created like a visual schedule for him, like, we're going to work on these things, but let's do it in an order, and you can check off this list when you're done with these things. And, you know, you can take a brain break and do the things that you want to do. That helped a lot. And then I think reintegrating back into school was probably a little bit harder than the actual lockdown, because mm-hmm. of everything being different than when he left. Everyone was wearing masks, and that just was very tough for him. Like having something on his face all day long was a little bit tough for him.
Yeah, I noticed that there was a lot of flashback or lash out about people saying their children coming into school not used to wearing masks. Some of them don't like it because of the feeling.
Right.
I mean, yeah, it's a tough thing. I mean, you're going from sitting in your own home comfortable doing a Zoom class to going back to school and everyone's wearing a mask and you got to wear it for 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
You can only take it off when you eat. How did he handle all that? Was he good with it? Was he...
I don't think he loved it. He didn't love it. But he worked through it. And now that, you know, the masks aren't required and things are kind of back to where they were before he left, I think he's very thankful. But I know that it really wasn't his favorite. And I noticed just him being more agitated, having to have something on his face all the time. But the good thing about him, you gotta love him, is he's just so positive about everything, that he did it and he worked through it. And now, you know, every day he can focus on the good. And mm-hmm. It's a very cool quality. I need more of that.
I think we all need to be like that. Look towards the positive and not look at the negative.
Exactly.
I mean, with the way the world's going today, I think we all need some positive in our life.
We really do. I can agree with that.
Now, what would you say the hardest part of your job is?
The hardest part of my job now, is when I truly want to assist and, you know, it's hard to figure out the mechanics because right now I do, you know, virtual training, and a lot of families, you know, it's hard to make that work. If you're moving around and you have your child at home with you, sometimes it's hard to kind of sit down and do, you know, the training. So that part is really tough. When I worked in actual ABA in a center, and you know, the hardest part was when I could see that a child needed more time and more dedicated therapy time, and their insurance company just said no, like didn't take into account their needs. They were just concerned about what the payout could be. That was the hardest part of the job. The insurance companies were tough.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, dealing with insurance and everything, when I got put on my I finally got a therapist, and I went through a clinical trial program I found for autism, and the medicine worked, and there was an excellent therapist. And then after they ended this trial, because they weren't getting the results, I wanted something that felt like I was on that same medicine. And this therapist, like, we talked, and he's like, okay, I'm going to put you on Adderall that will help you with your focus. Well, dealing with the insurance company is a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
And if you're not familiar, and I've learned this from talking with a friend of mine, if you're not comfortable advocating for yourself and you don't know how to talk to the insurance company and ask them the right questions, you're still getting a runaround.
Yep. Yeah, there was one time that I tried to independently bill insurance just to help, you know, a family out, and it was incredible how many different numbers I had to call and how many times I was redirected and given information and then redirected, and they said, no, that's not the right information. It's just insane. And, you know, for a person who's trying to advocate for themselves or for their child, that's just unacceptable.
Should be easy.
It should be much easier. I understand. I mean, it's money. They're trying to, they have to pay for stuff, but it should be easier.
Now, when you have a family coming to you to look for an ABA program or even for yourself, what do you tell them about ABA? Do you explain it and break it down to them and like, this is what we're going to do and this is what's going to happen?
If someone is coming to me and I'm providing services for them, then we sit down, we talk about what goals are going to help them and what we want to be working on. And then I come up with a plan, a protocol, and all of our sessions are helping towards those goals. When they're looking for another ABA program that their child can attend in person, then I have kind of guidelines that I'm like, here's what questions I would ask if it were me as a parent going in. And here's what I would want to hear. Like, I would want to hear that all of the treatment goals are individualized. They don't come from like a set curriculum, because there are there's actual programs out there that have curriculums or curricula, and they just follow that. So it's like the child will receptively identify 20 pictures, and then the child will just like moving on. And that's fine and that's good if those programs are what's best for the child. But if they're not, do you have a plan in place of how to modify things? So that's always one thing I look out for. And another thing is, like I mentioned earlier, if they're willing to go out into the community, into the home, into like if if the child wants to participate in social activities, is the therapist able to be there instead of just one environment all the time? So I have, you know, things that I'm like, ask this question, ask about this. And this is what I would expect to hear if it's a program I would want to be in.
Mm-hmm. Now, how hard is it when you're working with someone who's nonverbal to get them to the point to where they're finally able to talk?
I wouldn't say it's hard. I would say it's systematic. So it's a long graduating process. And a lot of it has to do with there's B.F. Skinner, who kind of is the first person to start implementing like an ABA. He categorized verbal behavior, like what are the different ways in which we use communication and how can we train those ways? And the first one that you work on is called a command, or it's like, it's a request asking for something. That's how we get command, demand. It's all like, mm-hmm. It's an attempt to get, and that's obviously the most motivating. So the way that I approach language is, it's not that I want to teach the child to talk. It's that I want the child to want to talk or want to communicate and realize that there's a value in doing it. Like if I work on this, this benefits me, because otherwise we're pushing an agenda on someone that is not something they're asking for. They're not asking to be taught how to talk. They need to see the value and want to learn. So I start always with something called like man training, where all we're doing is we're in a play environment. And I try to bring things that that child is really going to enjoy and really going to love. So if the child loves bubbles, I hold the bubbles and I will blow the bubbles and try to teach the child how to ask me how to do that. So they're getting something they really, really want. And they're noticing, hey, when I interact with you and I say something to you, that produces something that's good for me. And I think that's where things get switched up. In a lot of ABA programs, it's like the parent wants the child to talk. So we're going to work on this way of trying to get them to talk. I don't think that is the first goal. The first goal is, let's teach this child that there's value to talking and value to communicating. And then from there, I mean, it's just very systematic steps. When the child starts to learn like, hey, language is good, I like it, then we start to train, here's all the ways that you can use your language. Here's how you label things that you see. Here's how you, you know, interverbal. We exchange, you know, different phrases and create a conversation. All of those are really great and good, but step one is, you know, creating the motivation, mm-hmm. knowing that it's for something.
So like if a client wanted water, you kind of teach them, if you ask me for the water, you get rewarded with the water.
Yes, but not in a way that that would ever deny access to things that they really need.
Yeah.
Like if they need water, they need water. They can have the water. But I might, you know, if they want to go swimming or they want to, you know, different ways to get things that they want, not necessarily a need, but if I were to start to teach them what water is, like if they need the water, I give it to them and I can like tell them that that is water, because eventually at some point, if the water is not in sight, I want them to still know how to ask me for it. Like if we're out and in the car and my child is thirsty, but there's no water around, I would want him to be able to say, I'm thirsty, I need water, or something like that. But I always typically start with toys, with videos, mm-hmm. things that aren't an essential, but things that the child might really want.
I mean, I can see how important that is, because when you get that want, that ask for the want, it's they realize they get rewarded by asking.
Exactly.
And in their mind, that registers to them, oh, I can, if I ask and if I verbalize, I'm able to express what I want and I get it. Instead of pointing to something by verbally saying something. Now, do you have clients who almost have trouble getting that word out because they have never spoken?
At times, but there's lots of cool ways to help with that. So you can use two different communication styles if you're building up one or the other. So for my son, when he started, he was starting by using a communication device, and he would listen to videos and he would pick up words there, but he was not quite getting that these words and these phrases, I can also say them and get an outcome. But when he learned how to use a device, he would press a button and the button would say the word and he could repeat it. And he started to learn like, hey, I can just say it. So if a child hasn't talked before, then there's lots of things that you could do to practice and still work on communication. I think people get wary of communication devices because it feels like they're giving up, like they're resigning to the fact that their child won't talk. But in all honesty, like it helped my son to start talking because he was hearing those words over and over and he felt more comfortable saying them when he could hear them more.
Yeah, I talked with a guest who works with getting those devices out to the kids and how important it is because they get the software, they get the iPad with the specialized software that has all the vocabulary. And I can understand how important that device is. If you're nonverbal, the world must feel different to you.
Yeah.
I mean, your son must, when he was younger, it must have felt weird for him to hear all these people talk. And I bet you inside, he just wanted to say, but he somewhere inside, he couldn't.
Yeah. I definitely felt for him because when he was nonverbal, he was overstimulated a lot. And I think it's because part of it is like exactly like you're saying, you can hear everything people are saying, but it's hard to process what those words mean. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to feel like you can participate in it when you can't say it yourself. And I really did feel for him in that time. And I think that's why I wanted to get the training that I wanted to get, because whether or not he actually spoke a word in his life, that part wasn't as concerning to me. What I was concerned with is, how are you heard? How are you, like, how do you communicate yourself to me or to people that you want to be heard with? So, you know, I was willing to try pretty much anything. We tried PECs and those darn things. I mean, it's a great system, but if you lose one or if you don't have a PEC for something that he needed, it was tough, but the device did help him quite a bit.
I've always wondered what in the autism world how do you wind up nonverbal? Is it just you're afraid to talk and stimulation, or what is it?
There are different diagnoses that sometimes do go hand in hand with autism. And one of them is apraxia. Apraxia of speech is a diagnosis for when the connection of your receptive language like going to your expressive language, there's something that gets very mixed up. So you can hear and understand language, but it creates kind of a jumble and you can't speak it. You can't get it out. We thought that my son had that. He ended up not. But I think that it's like a balance, right? So your level or where you are on the spectrum might have to do with all kinds of things. I mean, there's a lot that was going on. He was getting chronic ear infections. Mm-hmm. And we think that inflammation in the eardrum could have prevented him from hearing or even being able to create. No one really knows for a fact what puts a person on one end of the spectrum or in the middle or anywhere else. But there are a lot of things coming out about inflammation in like the brain, inflammation in the body, and how that increases a lot of autism type of characteristics. And I will say, and this might not be applicable for everyone, but when I started paying attention to what my son was eating, mm-hmm. and making sure that his nutrition was up to par, he had a lot of changes in his vocabulary and in his speech. So I think it's being conscientious of your whole body, not just your output and your behavior, but what's going on mm-hmm. with all within you. Because there could be a million things as to why a child's not talking. So you gotta play like that old show House, where the doctor mm-hmm. like was always, you know, it went through a million different things before you could figure it out. You almost have to do that with everyone. Everyone has their own makeup, and what could be going on with one might not be the same for someone else.
I mean, I've always been an advocate ever since I found out I have autism about listening to your body. Mm-hmm. Because I have a friend who's like, how can you be this way? And so on and so forth. You are so on this fence of you're not even, don't have all the things, all the traits. And I'm like, well, the thing is, I listen to my body. I know when I'm overtired. I know when I'm overstimulated. And I know when I feel certain things, I know it's time for me to step back. Like when I'm at a party, I know when I'm overstimulated, I find a quiet place to go mm-hmm. before my mind snaps and I have a meltdown.
Yep. I found that with myself as well. This is when I start to realize, you know, I have a lot of these characteristics myself. And one of the biggest ones was like the grocery store. I can't do the grocery store. And even like, we just went to go get like teething toys for my baby. And even the few amount of people in there, I was just getting very overwhelmed, because you have to consider like where your body placement is and your cart and like the different sounds. And there's always music playing in it. So when I would have to go shopping on my own, I wear headphones. I do something that kind of mm-hmm. blocks it out so I can be focused on what I'm there to do. And at first I thought, you know, like, is this just something I don't like? But no, that's just the way I receive stimuli. And I just need to be conscientious of that. I mean, we all have our things.
Well, they've always said that the autism is hereditary, in the fact that you either get it from your mother or your father. So maybe you could be on the spectrum. Have you thought about getting yourself tested?
I've done self-tests. I mean, at this point, if I've, you know, been through, you know, the education that I have, and it's more, there's not really a ton of treatment for people my age with my type of characteristics. So I haven't thought about getting myself, you know, clinically diagnosed, because there's not a lot out there for me at this point. But I do self-tests and self-evaluations, and I do meet the criteria. And what's funny about genetics and hereditary is that is, it's like one small part of it. I follow Dr. Mark Hyman, and he does like a lot on functional medicine. And if you consider, you know, the prevalence of autism, where a couple decades ago we're looking at 1 in 5,000 children might have it, now we're looking at like 1 in 44. Genetics, just, they don't change that fast. Like they can't evolve for it to be, you know, hardly anyone to now almost everyone. Like it doesn't add up. But what does add up is, if you share genetics, like my son and I, if I'm sensitive to something in the environment, and I'm sensitive to something in my diet, and I'm sensitive to certain stimuli, it's likely that he would be sensitive to those things too. So the same things that would cause inflammation for me are highly likely. So for instance, I tested going off of gluten. And this isn't right for everyone. I'm not saying everyone should be on a gluten-free diet. I'm saying, like, for me, I noticed a high amount of irritability, you know, much more fatigue, dark circles around my eyes when I was eating it. And then I also noticed the same with Caden, but with, you know, it being him being so young and not being able to articulate every feeling that he might have and every, you know, frustration he might have, it just, it comes off as overstimulation. It comes off mm-hmm. as having a meltdown, and really his body's just trying to process through, the things that I also can't tolerate. So genetics are a huge part of it. And yeah, I do consider myself probably somewhere on the spectrum. I just, I haven't tried to get diagnosed because there's no therapy for 36-year-old BCBAs who discover they have it.
Now, what is your feeling about masking and trying to pretend you're somebody you're not? Are you for it? Are you against it?
Always against. Because I say this with experience, because mm-hmm. I grew up very different. I went to a very small private Catholic school, and everybody seemed the same, and I seemed very different. So I lived a lot of my life just trying to fit in the best that I could. And it's very, not only is it very taxing on yourself, mm-hmm. it takes a lot of your energy, and it never really works anyway, because, you know, what people think is cool or what people think is acceptable is highly depending on whatever group. And it changes all the time. You might as well just be yourself, you know. you might as well just do what you're going to do and be, because at least you feel true to yourself. I think the biggest feeling for me was when I was doing those things, I just felt a betrayal to myself. And I don't ever want my child to feel that way. You know, my son at 10 years old, you know, he loves to film air conditioners. He has a collection of fire alarms that he knows every make and model of them. I don't ever want
that's
him
to. That's his special interest right there.
He is his special, very special interest. And he's so passionate. And like, he doesn't spend a single minute of his day doing something unproductive. It's always for these things that are of his interest. I would never want him to lose that, because like the 20 to 25 kids in his one classroom don't think it's cool. You know, it's might as well just be who we're going to be.
I mean, I've talked with many people and they've all said that their sons or their husbands who are on the spectrum come home exhausted and have to find a place to melt, to mellow out for at least 45 minutes. And I'm thinking to myself, why? It's not even worth masking if you have to come home and unwind for that long in the place of quietness? No. I've been against masking for the longest time because, as many people say, why shouldn't we hide our uniqueness?
Exactly. And the world has plenty of people who are going to belong to a certain group or look a certain way. Mm-hmm. We do better as a community when everyone is a little bit different and everybody has a different, you know, perspective, and anyone has a different skill to offer up. And, you know, we really can't thrive as a whole if everybody is trying to do the same thing. I don't believe in normalizing things, because everybody, you know, whether they fit into a group or whether they fit into what looks normal or not, that's going to change. Like next year, someone decided for women that having really big eyebrows, like having painted on eyebrows is cool. Like, who? And that's going to change. Like, so all of your energy, there's this part of a movie. I might be completely like out, like nerding, whatever. But there is this part in this movie called the X-Men First Class. And the one Mystique who could like shape change, she could like become anybody, and she's like trying to lift weights and she can't do it because she was using all of her energy trying to look like a normal person instead of just her typical form. I know that's like a lot of detail, but I think about that all the time. Like, if we were to use our energy just by doing what we do better, instead of trying to look like everybody else, you know, we'd be much better off. That's a much better use of our energy.
And finally, what would you tell people who are looking to find into ABA and are skeptical about it? What would you tell them?
Keep your skepticism. Always, you know, you look out for the best interest of your child. What I love to tell parents more than anything else is that your gut, like you are biologically programmed to be this child's parent. So if something in your gut says this isn't right, you're probably right. And you should figure out what that is. We all of us people who have the credentials and we have the fancy diplomas and we do the fancy therapies, we know the practice. You know your child. And if something is not right for you, you don't have to be able to explain it. You can just say, this doesn't feel right to me. And always be educated on what the therapy should be doing, how it should look, and watch, pay attention to your child. Like, make sure that that person is respecting your child's dignity and their uniqueness.
And that's it, everyone. Thank you for another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Thank you, Melissa, for a wonderful show.
Thank you for having me. This is so much fun.
And I'll see you on the next one, everyone.
Miss the way things used to be. I'm no big fan of now. I must have some sweeter memories somewhere in the cloud. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Shout. Welcome to the new normal. Gonna miss all you used to be. Gonna miss all you had. Consigned to the dustbins of history like opinions from your dad. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Welcome to the new normal. Shout. Talk to the freaks, you can talk to just about anybody you happen to meet. It ain't what it was, and it is what it is.